The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Good evening, everybody. Good evening. Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia's author events. My name is Sarah Henningstout, and I have the singular privilege of being Katrina Van Grau's publicist. I'm really delighted to see you all here tonight, and I hope you know that you're in for an evolutionary treat. Before I introduce Katrina properly, I want to take a minute to extend my gratitude to Andy Cahan and the whole FLP events team for having us and for all of the exceptional work they do to bolster Philadelphia's reputation as a thriving hub for readers, thinkers, and the civically engaged. Now, to Katrina. I have worked at Princeton University Press for a little over a year now, and I can safely say that there is no author more universally adored than Katrina Van Grau. In her life and work, Katrina inhabits the liminal space between art and science. A self-taught scientist with a passion for evolutionary biology and its history, she holds degrees in fine art and natural history illustration and is a former curator of ornithological collections at a major UK museum. Author of The Unfeathered Bird, a book that Jim Gorman of the New York Times called unsettling and irresistible, Katrina's much-anticipated follow-up, Unnatural Selection, is a celebration of selective breeding that pays homage to Charles Darwin's theory of natural selection. Without further ado, please welcome Katrina Van Grau.
Thank you very much. Thank you for coming, and it's truly wonderful to be back at the Free Library of Philadelphia. This picture here, this is the title page for my new book, A Natural Selection. I call it The Ascent of Mallard. The book is all about selective breeding. Now, that's different from domestication. Domestication is what we do to wild populations, populations of wild animals, to turn them into self-sustaining populations of tame animals. But selective breeding is the ongoing process of taking those tame animals and making them more productive, more beautiful, more interesting. And it's something that carries on and on. Now, this talk is actually really about selective breeding on a far, far grander scale. A scale that we know actually by a different name. We'd call it evolution. And most of the evolutionary principles I'm going to be talking about will probably be familiar to you, but maybe not in this context. But this actually is the context that Charles Darwin himself used to explain how evolution works. But this isn't going to be a lecture about evolutionary biology. It's just going to be a look at how people actually view domesticated animals and some of the prejudices that that people have against them. Because domesticated animals aren't taken very seriously. We think of them as cute and sort of fluffy things for the children. Scientists and naturalists especially, it's very sad, don't take domesticated animals that seriously at all. It's not considered to be a serious subject. It hasn't always been that way, though. Once upon a time, early 19th century, you could open a natural history book, bird book, and you would see domesticated animals listed alongside all the wild species in the world. And that wasn't because it was a mistake. It wasn't because they thought that they were wild. It was truly because they existed. These books weren't, this is from a pre-Darwinian era, a pre-evolutionary era. They weren't trying to describe things in their evolutionary order. They were just describing the things that exist on the planet, just a catalogue of biodiversity. People have been breeding animals for a long, long, long time, and nobody would disagree with the idea that animals change. Animals do change, but people thought that they changed in a linear way. So all of those pigeon breeds we saw a moment ago, they believed that they had The equivalent types, the equivalent breeds going way back in history, maybe even wild ancestors, and they even gave them scientific names. They, believe all these things had a similar ancestor that may be a little bit different, but it was still recognisable as a fantail or a pouter or a carrier and so on. If anyone was cataloguing the birds of the world and was seeing some of these pigeon breeds for the very first time, they would probably, as Darwin pointed out, they would probably describe them all as separate species. It would be a bit like looking down on the top of a tree, on top of a very, very big tree or a forest, and all you can see is just the tips of the branches. And you don't know where those branches spring from, which branches, which twigs are attached to which branch, whether they even branch at all. All we can see, the leaves and the tips of the twigs, all we can see in biodiversity is the animals that actually exist at any one period of history. But they do branch. Instead of having ancestral pouters and jacobins and so on, they came from a common ancestor, the rock dove. And what works in domesticated things also works in nature. And that branching phylogeny is no different at all from Darwin's own branching diagram that he wrote, that he drew up when he was working out how evolution happens, Darwin's tree of life. So let's take them from the other way then. Let's look at the ancestral form, still in the world, still living on the cliffs of many areas, the rock dove. And being cliff nesters, they're perfectly at home on the ledges of buildings, also in dovecots. So people would breed them and keep them for meat. And when a naturally occurring mutation just happened, something a little bit different, people would maybe like it and they'd maybe breed from it. And gradually, over time, over hundreds and hundreds of years, we had this branching diversity of all these different breeds. Some of them completely unpigeon-like, nothing whatsoever like the good old-fashioned rock dove. There we are. All one species. And branching occurs in other domesticated animals too. This was the old-fashioned toy spaniel that was made famous from the paintings and about the time of Charles II. You can see many of these pictures in art galleries today. And one person who'd seen those pictures in art galleries was an American named Roswell Eldridge. And when he went to Crofts in 1925, he was looking around for these really sweet little spaniels. He adored them. But all he saw were these little snub-nosed dogs, completely different, but actually the same breed. By this time, they went under a different name, but they were the same breed. And he put up a prize. He actually advertised and put up a money prize, a big money prize, for spaniels of the old-fashioned type, typical of the paintings of King Charles II. And breeders rose to the call. And then a new breed was born. Suddenly we now had Cavalier King Charles Spaniels. Cavaliers and King Charles Spaniels were never again interbreed. They've split their two branches on the same tree, and they will continue to go their different ways, exactly like branching evolution in nature. Animals are plastic things. They change over time. This is an old-fashioned fantail, gradually morphed into this. In wild animals, changes that occur take thousands, millions of years to happen. But in domesticated animals, we can see those changes happening in just a few animal lifetimes. Here's a bull terrier, around about 1900, and gradually over time, notice that the top of the skull stays the same, but the rotation of the muzzle goes right the way down, and now the present-day bull terrier has got that lovely, rounded, very characteristic face. Now, these changes weren't lost on Darwin, and we always think about Darwin as an intrepid traveller. We think about the Beagle Voyage, we think about the Galapagos, but Darwin was actually more influenced by the pigeons that he kept and the colleagues' animals that he kept around him in England. And if you start to read when I was 16, I began to read On the Origin of Species. I didn't get very far. I thought it was going to start with intrepid things about adaptations in wild animals, and it had a whole long, long chapter about pigeons, which at the time I found terribly boring, and I didn't realise I'd be doing a book about that sort of thing in the future. He began his book that way, though. It was a really clever move. He began it that way because everybody in England at the time kept animals. They loved them. All social classes, they all kept animals of different sorts. And for Darwin, this was a really smart way of introducing a very difficult concept of how evolution works, because natural selection shows that all the diversity on the planet can come about without a divine creator, but without a designer. It can come about without a conscious plan. And that is, it was certainly in Victorian England, and I believe it is still now a very scary idea. So Darwin started his book with this comfortable concept that lured people in, put them in their comfort zone, and introduced this frightening idea in a way that they could understand and relate to. It was a spoonful of sugar to make the medicine go down. So we talked a little bit about natural selection. I'll just quickly tell you what it actually means. It's a beautiful, simple, elegant equation. And it goes on the basis that all individuals, I mean individuals, you know, you and me sort of individuals, are all slightly different. And those differences can be passed down from one generation to another. And in the struggle for existence, sometimes these differences give us a competitive advantage over others. And in the long term, those advantages are then passed down to the next generation. If they help something breed successfully, they'll be the ones that are passed down to the next generation and on and on, as long as the environment doesn't change. Let's look at it in equation form then. Variation and inheritance, well, heritable variation plus selection. You've got a random element and a non-random element equals evolution. If you take nothing home from you from tonight, other than one thing, let it be this thing. Survival of the fittest is one of the most, is the most misleading, misinterpreted, and downright dangerous phrases in the history of science. We're not talking, the problem is, we're talking about fittest, but of course it's good to be fit. You know, of course the fittest animals will have an advantage, but it isn't about that sort of fitness, and it's not about survival either. It's about reproductive success. It doesn't matter how long you live if you don't have any offspring. It's about reproductive success of the animals best fitted to their environment. Take this example. If you had the capacity to develop a great thick woolly coat and it happens to be the onset of an ice age, then you're going to be at an advantage. If you develop that thick woolly coat and it's at the onset of global warming, you're going to be in big trouble. Let's bring it back to a domesticated thing now. If you've got a capacity to develop a non-molting coat, one that just grows and grows and grows and grows, you're going to be in big trouble if you're a wild animal because you'll trip over it and it'll get caught on bushes and brambles and things and it'll slow you down. So you don't want a non-molting coat if you're a wild animal. But if you happen to be amongst people who can shear that coat off once a year, if you happen to be a sheep, it's a very good thing to have indeed. Because a non-molting coat allowed the whole boom in the woolen industry. You can take that fleece off, you can sell it. Woolen industry gets suddenly really successful. Of course, sheep don't care about the wool industry and about economics. All sheep care about is breeding, which is precisely what having a non-molting coat allowed them to do. It was a favourable trait in the environment where they lived, and therefore those sheep would become successful. Okay, the next prejudice statement that I'm very familiar with, domesticated animals are just man-made freaks. And you might think that is probably true if you look at a little round-headed dog like this and it's a rather horrific skull there. Well, let's face it, there are. I mean, of course, no one's condoning the deliberate breeding of animals that are have difficulty breathing, and have all sorts of health problems. I'm not saying that, but let's face it, there are some pretty freakish things in nature too. And if people say to me, look what humans have done to toy dogs, I might reply, well, look what flowers have done to saw-billed hummingbirds. This is a pretty freakish looking thing. This is a naked-necked chicken. And you might prefer your chickens with feathers on their neck, but nobody questions it if it's animals like marabou storks and ostriches and vultures. And it's probably actually the same process, the same genetic process that causes this. Now, for marabou storks and so on, it's a really good thing to have when you're living in a hot environment because the blood vessels are near the surface of the skin and it's a way of cooling off. For chickens, not necessarily a good way of cooling off. These are actually from Romania. Not very hot there. But it's also in the right environment because it's in a human environment and humans like weird things. So you get something unusual like this. Hey, great. let's keep this one. For both animals, it's an advantage in that environment to have a naked neck. On the subject of chickens, this is Peter Bauman. Now, Peter Bauman was a travelling salesman in Iowa in the 1940s, and every so often he'd go to a poultry farm. He was a travelling salesman of veterinary products, and every so often he'd go to a poultry farm and somebody would show him a weird little chick that was born with stunted wings or with no wings, and just a curiosity. And he'd say, "Oh, do you mind if I have it?" "Oh, yeah, sure, take it." And Peter built up a self-sustaining population of totally wingless chickens. Peter Bauman didn't like chicken wings. He assumed nobody else did either. And he also had another weird idea. The caption for this photo says that he's proudly showing off his chickens, next held in by an 18-inch high fence. And for him, this was a really good thing because it was a way of saving money on fencing. Nobody told Peter Bauman that the reason for fencing in poultry is to keep predators out rather than keep the chickens in. So wingless chickens is a pretty gross idea, right? Well, maybe not. Maybe not. There's a group of birds in New Zealand that have had, they're extinct now, absolutely no wings at all. They are extinct now. There were 9 species that we found so far. Lots and lots and lots of fossil evidence, lots of bones found over many years. And amongst all those bones, not a single vestige of wing bone, shoulder bone, any sort of bone connected to wings. It's possible, of course, that that may have happened by gradual reduction over many, 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 many centuries. But you'd have thought we'd have found a bit of bone by now, a bit of wing bone by now. It's equally possible, I'm not actually putting this forward as a theory, I'm just making a suggestion that it's equally possible that moas were actually just the big rat-eye equivalent of wingless chickens. The M word, breed from mutations. Now, that's something you don't want to go telling people. You don't want to go mentioning the M word, they get very upset. They conjure up visions of bearded ladies, two-headed lambs, all sorts of freaks and monstrosities. Well, mutation actually does not mean monster. I'll show you a monster. Ladies in the audience and anyone with a delicate disposition might want to close their eyes at this point. I'm only supposed to say, ah. Yep, things like six-legged puppies and four-legged ducks might be what we think of when we think about mutations, monstrosities, but these are not mutations in the evolutionary sense at all. This sort of thing results from accidents in cell division in the developing embryo. If you were to breed birds like this many generations, you almost certainly wouldn't have any more four-legged ducks coming out. Almost certainly not. When we talk about mutations, what we really mean is tiny little errors in copying DNA, just small things, like the differences between the alleles that we all learn about in biology classes, blue eyes and brown eyes, or slight differences in height, or straight hair or curly hair. Small things, really small things. And in fact, it's mutations that are responsible for all the diversity on the whole planet. This bad word, this bad M word, is actually what makes us all those individuals. Sometimes these variations are more marked than others. And what's wrong with this chicken? You might not be able to see it with the feathers on, so we'll try it like this. It's actually got, you might say it's got short legs, but when you see it without the feathers on, you can see it's got short wings too. And this is a disproportionate dwarf. It's called achondroplasia. But disproportionate dwarfism, only the limb bones are stunted and the rest of the body is normal sized. Looks a bit weird in a bird, but we're quite used to seeing it in things like this. And there's a cat version too. Come on. There we are. A munchkin. A little otter. And some people think it's rather cruel to breed short-legged cats deliberately, but we did actually go and meet a whole load of munchkins at a breeder's house. There were about 40 of them, all dashing about the place like mad things. And trust me, munchkins can climb up the curtains as well as the next cat. disproportionate dwarfism is actually really common. It occurs all the time as a sudden, spontaneous mutation in wild animals as well as domesticated ones. This is not something wrong that we do to animals. It happens all the time. It happens in elephants and foxes and all sorts of things. And who's to say that some of our short-legged animals in nature didn't actually have a head start by this sort of mutation? Not all the way, but maybe just a bit of a head start on which, you know, there was continued selection over many thousands of years. Things like weasels, for example. Who knows? It all depends on the environment, what sort of environment favours short limbs, and environments come in all different shapes and sizes. For this particular sheep, the environment was very strange indeed, and it happened to be another American farmer who was very funny about saving money on fencing. This sheep with short limbs was born to a farmer in Massachusetts in the 18th century, and he thought, hey, this is a great idea. If I build up a whole flock of these sheep, I won't have to spend any money on mending my fences. And he actually did. He kept this lamb, and he bred, and he built up an entire flock of short-legged sheep, which became internationally famous and eventually came to the attention of a young Charles Darwin. Now, here he is on the left. Things like short-legged sheep, though, really confused Darwin, because they may not be able to leap over fences, but it was certainly, to him, a major evolutionary leap. And he believed very strongly that nature happened, that the changes happened in tiny, tiny steps. You've got to remember that at that time, everybody thought that the world was young. And Darwin was kind of jumping up and down saying, no. Deep time, the world is very old and the changes happen really gradually. There are no big changes. And he was leaping up and down saying, metaphorically speaking, saying, natura non facit saltus. Nature does not make leaps. On the other end of the scale, there was, in the 1940s, Richard Goldschmidt said that nature does make leaps. He coined the term hopeful monsters, and he thought that some of the biggest evolutionary divisions in the animal kingdom could only be caused by big, big, big mutations, what we would normally call monstrosities. And he was met with ridicule at the time, but in fact, it's not actually that impossible. It's not that crazy. Maybe not through things with too many legs or heads, but a major phenotypic change, a major change in the outward appearance of an animal can happen just by one tiny genetic switch, just one flick of a switch, and it's like diverting a railroad into a new fork, a new branch on the tree. Mutations tend to happen in one go to start with, but then you've got continued selection on that. This is a frillback pigeon. That was a type of pigeon that Darwin kept himself, and I've seen pigeons like this actually strutting around London. It's a mutation that can happen on its own, like all of the others, not a human thing. But when humans like it, humans will select on that trait. So a bird like this would have been kept by Darwin, and he would have been so delighted to have seen what frillback pigeons would become just with continued selection. Big changes don't only happen in structure of feathers and so on, also in colour. And this is Boris. Boris lives in Maine. And this is Boris to show you how a small genetic change in colour can actually bring about big changes in the outward appearance. Boris is a macrostriped tabby cat, and the striping is caused by a thing called a guti patterning, and that's where the hairs themselves are banded. So you've got a dark bit, a light bit, and a dark bit. And in the stripes, the hairs are solid coloured. The stripes stay the same no matter what, but the colour is influenced by two sorts of the same pigment, melanin. Melanin occurs right the way through the whole animal kingdom. Boris has two melanin pigments. He has blue-black eumelanin and reddish-brown pheomelanin. He's got both, which is why he's that lovely colour. But if you take away, if he was born without the eumelanin and just the pheomelanin, he'd be a tabby cat. A ginger cat. Notice that he's still got the same white spots, they're caused by leucism, and all the stripes are in exactly the same place. If he was only born with eumelanin, not pheomelanin, he'd be what we call a silver tabby. And if he had an extra overdose of melanins and they filled in the spaces in those banded hairs, he would be a black cat. Black cats are just tabby cats with the spaces filled in. Tiny genetic changes, major, major outward signs. And let's have a look at birds as well to do a different bird version. This exercise is called Let's Colour a Gordian Finch. Birds, Gordian finches have got two different sorts of pigments. They've got carotenoids, which are yellow and red, and they've got melanins as well. There's a further complication in that the feather structure can actually heavily influence the outward colour as well, the final colour. So, first pigment we'll put on is carotenoids. There we are. Beautiful red and yellow plumage. Absolutely lovely. All of these variations occur in aviculture and may well occur in the wild as well, historically. So let's now add eumelanin to some of the areas. There we are. Notice that the yellow is still untouched. That's there's no melanin on there. But where the melanin overlies the yellow, blue and yellow make green. Therefore, you've got green bits and you've got blue bits. Just like adding transparent layers in a watercolour painting or a silkscreen print. Now let's add the pheomelanin. Now, because of the feather structure, this reddish-brown pigment now turns out purple. And this is the way Gordian finches look in the wild. But we can remove pigments too in aviculture. So let's take away the eumelanin. Now we've just got the carotenoid and the pheomelanin. Lovely. And to the other way around, just leave the eumelanin. We've just got a little blue and white bird. Small changes, big final product, big end products. And it's not only about colour or feather structure or fur structure. It's also, or even the length of bones, it's also about the numbers of bones. I'm not talking about extra functional limbs here. I'm not talking about other, you know, like winged horses and that sort of thing. That's impossible. No, actually, winged horses are not impossible. It's just that you'd have to go so far back down the evolutionary tree that everybody would have six limbs, all vertebrates would have six limbs, and it wouldn't be anything special. What I am talking about is extra sections, extra segments, and they can be added really easily. This is a wild boar, and they've usually got 18 vertebrae. But individuals do vary. And when you've domesticated these and you're keeping them for meat production, you want a really big pig with a really long body to produce loads and loads of pork. You're not actually selecting these for extra meat, for extra bones. You're selecting them purely for meat. And if you're doing that, you might actually end up selecting for extra bones without even knowing it. Commercial pig breeds have got up to 24 vertebrae and extra ribs attached. It's actually really easy in nature for extra sections, extra vertebrae, the ribs and all the other tissues to be added on. Very, very easily, and more familiar than you might think. There we are. Animals should be fit for the purpose they were originally bred for. This is quite a common complaint, and there are two factions, the people that want to keep animals the same, even if they're not being bred anymore for actually fighting bulls or cockfighting and so on. People want them to be, in theory, fit for purpose. And the other faction want them to be, make the most of breeding for different traits and seeing how far they can go. These are all bulldogs, and only the top one is actually the type of bulldog that would have been used for baiting bulls. The other two are about 50 years apart in every case. Now, bulldogs and game fowl became redundant in the early 19th century when they passed the Cruelty to Animals Act. Bulldogs unemployed, game fowl unemployed, and fanciers adopted these breeds, they set up standards and so on. And again, it was, in the case of game fowl, some people favoured the ones that were theoretically fit for purpose, and others thought, hey, what a beautiful chicken, let's really enhance the aesthetics of this. Now it's not being used for fighting anymore. And this is what we end up with, another evolutionary tree. Working animals, unemployed, shock. Them branches, the working animals don't change very much because they've got to be actually fit for really doing the job, and the job makes, you know, it keeps them in evolutionary stasis. Whereas if you try and make them fit for purpose, they are going to change. Maybe slowly, but they are going to change because you're in a competitive exhibition environment instead of a fighting environment. And the other faction, to hell with the original purpose, let's just have fun, and that goes whizzing up, you know, rapid change. Let's look at bulldogs now. Working animals unemployed. Again, evolutionary status. Bulls will keep bulldogs the same. They probably were unchanged because any variation, any difference from the norm would have meant bull wins, bulldog, bull one, bulldog nil. Take them out of that situation, pit them against each other in a show situation where the winners get to breed, and then you get something very different happening indeed. Whoosh, right off the evolutionary scale, and there's nothing you can do about it. Even with show standards can be rewritten, and it goes on. It's like a carrot on a stick. It goes on and on and on, and there is no way you can keep animals the same. It's very much like the runaway process in nature that you have in sexual selection and in arms race type of selection, where you get rapid change that just goes off the scale and self-perpetuates. Domesticated animals are all inbred. Now, forgive the web foot thing here. I couldn't resist that. People tend to criticise breeders for inbreeding, even when what they really mean is selective breeding. Inbreeding is a term we bandy around like a weapon. But nobody is that quick to actually call Mauritius kestrels or Galapagos finches inbred. Even though Mauritius kestrels were brought back from the brink of extinction, from just a handful of individuals, Galapagos finches all descended from just a few waifs and strays that landed on the, washed up on bits of floating vegetation. Inbreeding isn't necessarily bad, and historically it can be a really good thing to weed out those deleterious genes, get those recessive genes together so that they show themselves, weed those individuals out of the population, cull ruthlessly. Our most celebrated English agriculturalist, Robert Bakewell, swore by the process of breeding what he called in and in, and he coupled that with ruthless culling. Not everyone is as conscientious as Robert Bakewell, though, and I do agree that there is some bad stuff that goes on in dog breeding and breeding of other animals commercially for profit. But it's important, it's vitally important to bring in a bit of historical perspective. Often the genetic bottlenecks that are responsible for the genetic diseases we have now were the result of a period way, way back in history before people really knew anything about genetics. Don't forget, the animals probably wouldn't show any signs of ill health, and this would have been at a time when, particularly during the wars, the Second World War especially, it's an indefensible luxury to keep big meat-eating animals like dogs when the people are starving. And so many breeds became extinct, so many breeds almost became extinct. This is a Sussex Spaniel, reduced to just 8 individuals. What do? Do you try and save the breed? Or do you say, oh no, there might be a problem with that? He didn't even know that there would be a problem. So, yes, let's be careful what we're doing now, but not be too quick to condemn people historically, because they were just doing their best. Let's give them a break. And some animals actually have no harmful side effects from inbreeding at all. None whatsoever. Who's got a golden hamster or has ever had a golden hamster as a pet? A few, yeah, good, excellent. Did you know? I mean, you've got something in common, because all your hamsters are related. All the golden hamsters in the world in captivity are all descended from one pregnant female that was caught in the wild in Syria in 1925. They have no problems at all. They breed, and they breed, and they breed. They breed like hamsters. There's no loss of fertility, no loss of vitality. They're perfectly normal, just the same as they always were. No genetic diseases at all. And they just go on and on and on. Inbreeding, breeding with their relatives, and there's no harm in it whatsoever. They wouldn't survive in the wild, and that's a very common one. That's the real sort of weapon of the people that I'd like to refer to as wild animal snobs. And the person who, I've put this Polish chicken here because somebody delighted in telling me recently, oh yeah, my parents used to keep these chickens and we had some Polish chickens among them. And when the goshawk came into the farmyard, all the normal chickens could run for cover. But the Polish fowl couldn't see the goshawk coming and they'd be the ones that were eaten. And he took great delight in saying, natural selection won, artificial selection nil. So I took great delight in pointing out that in the future there will still be Polish fowl kept by people in the days when there will be no goshawks left. And let's face it, there ain't much wild left. most of the habitat on the planet is human habitat. We are, like it or not, we are on the brink of the next great extinction event, and it will be the little snub-nosed dogs that are the evolutionary success, long after all the wolves have gone. But that's still a triumph for the wolf. It's still Canis lupus, it's still wolves that become that successful. There will always be dogs, there will always be chickens, there may not always be wolves, there may not always be jungle fowl. And in wild animals, the animals that are capable of doing this and this, they will be the ones that thrive in a human environment in the future. The question is whether these animals are tame because they've learned it from their small population, or whether they're tame genetically, and this is something that can be passed down from generation to generation. And genetic tameness was something that this man, Dmitry Believ, believed happened. He really thought that tameness was something that was going to be passed down. Believ was a Russian geneticist. He fled to Siberia during Lysenko's persecution, and he set up a fox farm. The idea of this fox farm was to select purely for tameness. All the animals that were aggressive or afraid, they would not be allowed to pass on their traits to the next generation. All the animals that were fearless or friendly, they were the ones that he would breed from. And within a few fox generations, he had lovely, happy, squirmy foxes that were so pleased to see you. They were genetically tame. He hadn't tamed them. He just bred them. And there was a whole suite of actual side effects, things like floppy ears and curly tails and different colours that seemed to actually be a byproduct of tameness. And this has actually raised questions about whether there is a domestication phenotype and whether we actually ourselves might be self-domesticated. Believ was a huge fan of selective breeding, and he understood that this was a big experiment on a grand scale, the biggest scientific experiment ever to happen in our history. And this experiment isn't going on in laboratories. It's not going on in universities. It's going on in farms, small holdings, backyards, houses. It's such a profound thing to do. Let's go back to natural selection equation for a second. Heritable variation equals plus selection equals evolution. We haven't talked much about the inheritance, and don't worry, we're not going to now, but inheritance was Darwin's sticking point. That was his big problem. Darwin he spent 20 years writing on the origin of species, and he would have spent a lot longer. He still didn't have the answers to two fundamental questions: where did the variation come from, and how is it passed down between the generations? He would have spent a lot longer, but something happened to make him speed up, and that thing that happened was Alfred Russell Wallace coming up with exactly the same theory that he'd spent 20 years actually formulating, which prompted Darwin to write on the origin of species in a great hurry. And he promised to publish another book in the future to tackle the questions of variation and inheritance. And that was this book, Variation of Animals and Plants Under Domestication. It's not a great book. It's very dry, very tedious. And to cap it all, he came up with the wrong answer. Darwin put loads of effort into this, though. He wrote to just about everybody. He thought and thought. He drove himself almost mad trying to work it out. He wrote to so many animal breeders, plant breeders, from the humblest gardener to the loftiest sort of racehorse stud owner. One person that he missed out of all this correspondence was a monk growing pea plants in a monastery garden in Brno. And that monk was, of course, Gregor Mendel, and he had the exact answer that Darwin was searching for. And my book is a tribute to what Darwin tried to do and so nearly accomplished. And it's out this year, which is exactly 150 years since Darwin published Variation Under Domestication. He described it as 4 years and 2 months of hard labour. Now, for me, it was 6 years and 2 months, and that was 6 years of working non-stop, 7 days a week, 10 hours a day. It was a real labour of love. We visited all sorts of lovely places, got to see lots of really nice animals, all sorts of farms, went to Belgium to find out about Belgian blue cattle and double muscling, lots of other people's pigeon lofts. We keep pigeons ourselves. Learned all about molt strategies in Onagadori long-tailed chickens. Believe me, it takes a very special type of chicken that can grow a 27-foot long tail. Had horse skeletons put together for me. Got to play with munchkin cats and kittens. Went all over Europe, gathering specimens, using museum collections, and just getting help from lots of breeders and other individuals. Not that dissimilar from what Darwin himself was doing. Had help also from America and American museums. I wrote a lot, read a lot, and thought an awful lot. Yes, there are anatomical specimens in the new book, as there were in The Unfeathered Bird as well. There's also pictures of live animals in this, and there was lots of boiling of skeletons going on at home in the kitchen stove. But this time, it could be anything from ducks to dachshunds. And then after the boiling was done, husband would put together the skeletons on the dining room table. We've got a really tiny house and a really small table, and it would have to be shared with cups of coffee, glasses of wine, dogs and cats, and that sort of thing. He'd also be putting these things together, not just in the right posture for the breed, but in the right posture for the breed in its period of history as well, which was quite an accomplishment. I don't think there's anyone else in the world that could have done what he did. Gradually, the pictures were done and the writing was done. There were 425 pictures in this book. It really took some doing. I chose again to make it a beautiful book, not something that looked dry and academic and full of anatomical diagrams. I wanted it to be a very beautiful book. There's a picture on every single double page spread, and chose that nice ivory coloured paper as well. Most importantly, though, this isn't just something that we researched and wrote about. It wasn't just book work. It was about the animals that we have at home. And husband actually should take credit for this, not me. He's been keeping animals since he was a little boy and doing all sorts of experimental breeding of the sort that would have delighted Darwin. For example, breeding leucistic pheasant and chicken together to see if the same gene's responsible for leucism. It's not. All sorts of experiments with colour in naked-necked pigeons. You have to read the book to find out why. And the insulating properties of certain feathers by doing a really clever experiment, which, again, you can read about in the book. Having the animals at home just made such a difference. It really is all about the way it took over our entire life. The Unfeathered Bird was actually dedicated to a dead duck originally, and we have to go to one of my other talks to find out why. Husband and I met when I was halfway through that book, and he helped it so much by preparing all the skeletons and putting them all together for me. So with him being a domesticated animal nerd, I produced a natural selection as a way of thanking him. Now, I'm sure that if he knew how much extra work it would involve, he would have just said, don't bother. First book was dedicated to Amy, who was actually a dead duck. This one, of course, had to be dedicated to husband, naturally. There he was as a little boy, and he hasn't changed much. Just in case you're wondering what happened to that four-legged duckling that I showed you earlier, well, she's alive and well. She's called Quad. She'd have to be. She's now only got two legs, not four. And she's a very much loved part of the family. Thank you very much. Are there any questions?
Well, hello. This doesn't relate directly to your presentation, but I'm curious about what caused the shift from, hello, I study art and I do art things, to I'm going to go ahead and teach myself to be a scientist.
I always wanted to be a scientist. Biology was actually my very first passion, and unfortunately, I shouldn't say that, but I was sort of shunted into doing art at school. I was good at it, and the school wanted the glory. But I was always really far more passionate about biology, and it was always a bit of a struggle because people would try to push you down one route or the other, and they didn't realise that all these routes can cross and you can do anything you want to do. But it's taken a long time to actually come back to where I actually want to be, which is great for me. And looking back sort of over my shoulder, I can see that the path is really clear, but of course when you actually go in there, you can't see that it's clear at all. I did spend many, many years just existing as an artist, and The Unfeathered Bird, which from conception to reality took 25 years, I thought that was going to be a one-off thing, and now after producing that, I just realised that it ticks all the boxes for me to do the writing and research and the artwork and produce a book. I mean, it is still being an artist because the final result is a book rather than a picture on the wall. But for me, it just ticks all the sort of creative and intellectual boxes. I can't really see myself ever going back to being just an artist anymore.
You had an equation there, heritable variation plus selection yields evolution. Mm-hmm. Is it also possible that heritable variation minus selection will cause evolution? I'm thinking of C-sections in humans. There's a tight fit between the baby's head and the mother's pelvis, and there's no longer selection against big heads in babies. So do you think that with the advent of cesarean section that babies' heads will get bigger?
The equation of natural selection relies on a reduction in variation. Otherwise, you're just going to have more and more different things without actually... I mean, it's ironic that in order to get diversity, you have to actually remove diversity. And the way the theory actually works is that it's like carving out a lump of marble to end up with the Venus de Milo inside. But it relies on removal of variation rather than just having... just having loads and loads of as much variation as you want. It relies exclusively on the removal of variation for it to work. And this was something that absolutely plagued Darwin when he was working on variation under domestication. He just couldn't work out how the way he thought that inheritance worked kind of went against the removal of it. There was a man called Fleming Jenkin who said that natural selection couldn't work because that would result in removal of variation. It doesn't work that way. They believed in blending inheritance, where you put two things together and get something which is a mixture of the two, which is a popular idea for many centuries, and it just doesn't work that way. You have to have the removal of the variation.
Do you have another project lined up for the future in mind?
Well, I'm a bit dubious about telling everyone because there's some copies of The Unfeathered Bird outside, which I want them to buy. But I am actually working on the second edition of The Unfeathered Bird, which will be a very different book, so don't let that put you off buying one. It's going to have an extra 100 pages, and it will include a lot of stuff about bird evolution from dinosaurs.
Thank you. I'm not sure I understood. You said that the chickens will survive, but not the goshawks?
I mean, possibly, potentially. I mean, in general, we're all worried about...
why.
Sorry?
Why would that be?
Well, we're all worried about the conservation of wild species. Things are actually depleting. There's not that much natural habitat left, and so on and so on. We have pesticides and so on that affect eggshell thickness. There's an awful lot of things threatening the existence of predators like goshawks, but there's not anything threatening the existence of weird chicken breeds, because there will always be weird poultry keepers who want to keep bizarre things. I mean, of course, I don't think that goshawks will become extinct, but it was just to sort of fling the idea in the person's sort of, in the face of the skeptic, to say, well, you know, goshawks are actually more likely to be in trouble than the chicken breeds will. Okay.
Thank you. With the greater diversity and the greater variation with, for instance, bred birds, is there sometimes a side effect where, an unintentional side effect, where this new bird, if you will, or this new species or new breed is unable to, for instance, think or problem solve or... is perhaps at greater risk of being killed as prey simply because of the variation in the way that they look?
I'm not entirely sure if I understand the question, but a lack of sort of survival instinct or a lack of intelligence to work
yes.
things out. Yes, I believe quite possibly, unfortunately, and that loss will never ever come back. Once that's gone, that's gone, and it won't ever re-evolve, or if it did, it would take... exceedingly long time. So, unfortunately, yes, we can actually see, even in, again, domesticated animals, you can see the same situation in a sort of speeded up, in an accelerated way. Certain dog breeds that used to be really intelligent now are less so. Things like Newfoundland. So if you read some of the stories about what some of these dogs actually did, I mean, it sounds like two tall stories, you know, for boys' magazines. But I think a lot of them were true. And I think we have actually bred some intelligence out of certain dogs, which is a bit sad. If you stop selecting for something actively, that thing will go. You have to continue to select all the time for that thing. And if you divide your interests and select for two things, then it's going to be compromised and you will lose stuff. They're not talking about intelligence here, but talking about a certain pigeon that makes a certain noise. There's a breed called a laugher, a kumru. And normal pigeons go woof, woof, woof. Kumrus go woof, 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 woof. It's really lovely. And it's just a sort of a single mutation that causes them to have this different call. And no amount of selection will make that call any different. They either do it or they don't do it. But if you continue to select for that call in your pigeon loft, then they will do it all day long. It just sounds like a whole troop of gibbons sharing a lewd joke. Husband had two friends, both of whom got some of these laughers from the same stock from Turkey. One of them selected them purely on the sound, and the other one selected them also on the looks, because they got nice white patches, and he liked that. Well, they don't have to have, but they did. The husband visited both people about 10 years later, and the one with who only selected on the sound, they were whooping and hooting all day long, and the others, they hardly made a noise at all because they weren't being continually selected on making that noise. So if you don't sort of keep pushing for something, it will fade away. It will get less, and that includes intelligence.
Thank you. I might have missed a point. In Darwin's Domestication, a book that you're just celebrating for 150th anniversary, he came up to the wrong conclusion, you said.
Yes, he did.
Gregor Mendel is the monk. Is that his name? Now, he came up with the right conclusion. Now, what is the right conclusion? I sort of missed that point, you know, if you...
I didn't go too much into to Mendelian genetics. Mendel basically had the answer to how things can be passed down from one generation to the next. People believed in a blending inheritance, and that included Darwin, and also the inheritance of characteristics that can be acquired during your life, which doesn't actually happen. It can happen in a small way between a few generations, but not in a meaningful, long-term, evolutionary way. But everybody, it was just the prevailing thought. People really believed that if you build up your muscles, you're going to have strong sons. You know. Darwin's conclusion was a theory called pangenesis, which was based on a theory from way back there, from Hippocrates, believe it or not. And it was about having gemmules in your body fluids, which could be influenced by things that happened to you during your life. And then when you had offspring, those gemmules would mysteriously be passed from one to the other. Darwin's own cousin did an experiment, though, by doing blood transfusions in rabbits, in different coloured rabbits. And friends like that, he wants enemies. His own cousin. And he published this in a journal to say that none of the rabbits changed colour as a result of these transfusions. And then Darwin very churlishly said, oh, I didn't say it happened in the blood.
But
I don't think he really believed it. He'd spent a long time on variation, and his interest had gone on to other things. He wrote to his friend Joseph Hooker about this, and he knew he was clutching at straws. I think he really did, but he couldn't find anything better. It's so ironic that he didn't actually know about Mendel. He possessed Mendel's paper, but it was written in German, and he had so much correspondence, he never got round to having it translated.
Thank you for your wonderful presentation. I have several questions, but I'll ask one which I think is most apropos to your presentation. So Darwin was famous for his work on natural selection within the wild. He's famous for working on domestication, unnatural selection as a model for natural selection. He also, and this is why I'm wondering if this is something you've thought of as a project, was a pioneer in describing sexual selection. Mm. and it, because it has much the same effect as other forms of selection, producing very wild, exotic varieties of differences between males and females. Yeah. And so I wonder if this is something you've given any thought to, given the, sort of your legacy with Darwinian theory and so forth, is that a possible idea for a future project?
There's quite a lot about that in the book. And what interested me in this particular example was the way that runaway selection in exhibition animals is very similar to sexual selection in the wild. In terms of future projects for me, I'm not sure how much time I've got left, seeing as every book takes about 6 or 7 years. There's only so much I can do. But yeah, there's a lot of great stuff out there that I'm really passionate about, and only so much time. Thanks. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.